The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming to join us on this belligerently, brutally hot evening. Just a reminder to turn off your cell phones before we get started, and please refrain from taking pictures in the hall. I am very pleased because we have Ahmed Rashid and we have Trudy Rubin here this evening. Trudy is she writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she knows of whence she writes. Having traveled to countries including Pakistan, South Korea, Iraq, Israel, and Lebanon, where she was one of only a few women journalists reporting in the 1980s. I'm sure many of you are familiar with her book, Willful Blindness, which collects her worldview columns on Iraq from 2002 to 2004. However, you may not know that Trudy was recently named the winner of the 2008 Edward Weintol Prize for International Reporting. The annual prize recognizes, quote, distinguished reporting on international and diplomatic issues, and is awarded by the Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy in Washington. Please welcome Trudy Rubin.
Well, I think we are very lucky tonight to have Ahmed Rashid here, because there's nobody that knows more about a subject that is probably going to be the number one issue, strategic challenge, facing the next president. And Ahmed has written about it through every stage. He's the author most recently of Descent into Chaos, the United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, that he was the first person who alerted the world to the seriousness of the Taliban in Afghanistan with his wonderful book, The Taliban, which is also on sale out front. He also has written Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam in Central Asia. And he is a regular contributor to the London Daily Telegraph, the New York Review of Books. He appears in the Washington Post and the International Herald Tribune, and you can hear him all the time on CNN, NPR, and the BBC World Service. So it is a great pleasure to welcome him. And before I do that, let me just say that I will give a brief introduction and be asking him some questions, and then after that we will open it up to the audience. And if I call on you to ask a question, please wait until the mic comes so that everybody can hear you, and be sure to ask a question, not make a lengthy statement. And having said that, it is with the greatest of pleasure that I welcome Ahmed Rashid. Let me just say a few words before I get to the questions. A couple of months ago, Admiral Mike Mullen, was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was asked what was the place from which he thought the next terrorist attack on the U.S. might come. And he didn't say Iraq, of course. He said the Fatah. What is the Fatah? The Fatah is the federally administrated tribal areas of Pakistan, the areas that border Afghanistan, and the Fatah is where al-Qaeda now bases and trains, where the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban are based, where Pakistani jihadi groups have sunk deep roots. And from the Fatah, they cross over and launch raids into Afghanistan. They plot terrorist attacks on Europe and perhaps on the U.S., and they threaten Pakistan itself, a country which, as you know, has nuclear weapons. And as I said, that may well be the biggest problem the next president faces. So I wanted to start out by asking Ahmed about something which you can read in a wonderful, lucid account in his new book. But I thought it's important to get a little background here. I wonder if you can tell us, why were bin Laden and the Taliban and al-Qaeda able to escape from Afghanistan and set up shop in the Fatah? What made this possible? And in talking about this, if you could talk a bit about the relationship between them and the Pakistani army and intelligence services.
Well, thank you very much, Trudy. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming. I have to tell you that Trudy is a very, very dear old friend. I keep telling her when she's going to rest up, but she always appears in the middle of the summer in Pakistan when all of us are sort of sheltering from the heat and wanders around and then tells me that she's just been to Iraq and Darfur and God knows where else. She's a great journalist and a wonderful friend. Well, you know, the war in Afghanistan was a minimalist war fought by the U.S. There were only about 800 Americans in Afghanistan by the time the Taliban were routed, which is an extraordinary amount. And people on the ground, American officers on the ground, were demanding from Rumsfeld that he provide more troops, more resources, and he was refusing to do so. And already, I think, the idea was that the U.S. military would be invading Iraq at some point, and they wanted to keep their powder dry, as it were, and keep their reserves. The problem was that there was, right from the beginning, there was, of course, the dependence on the anti-Taliban warlords and an over-dependence on these warlords to try and hunt down al-Qaeda as they started fleeing the country. I recount in my book, for example, American commanders insisting that U.S. Rangers who were based in Uzbekistan in Central Asia should be deployed immediately to cordon off Tora Bora so that the al-Qaeda remnants could not escape from there into Pakistan. The American generals and the Defense Department just don't do it. So I think, you know, right from the beginning, there has been this tragic story of the lack of resources. And I felt that very strongly coming to New York just after 9/11, when you went to the 9/11 site, I mean, the Twin Tower sites, and you saw all the, you know, the people who must have died there, etc. The fact that this war was not being taken seriously, the resources were not being made available, and, you know, a person like myself wondered, you know, what on earth is going on? I mean, you know, the U.S. has over 1 million men in arms, and they can't even provide a few thousand troops. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the Taliban was never really defeated. Nor was al-Qaeda. They were routed from Afghanistan, and many were killed, but the rest fled into Pakistan. And Pakistan had a very long-running relationship with the Taliban. It had supported the Taliban regime in the 1990s, and they were given this ultimatum on September 12th by Colin Powell and by Richard Armitage, the Secretary of State and his deputy, and they had no choice but to side with the U.S., and the U.S. then did build an effective regional alliance of countries around Afghanistan who would provide support to the war effort. But once the war was over, the Pakistan military, which was ruling the country, Musharraf had taken over in a coup 2 years earlier, decided to, once again, house the Taliban and keep them as a reserve force in case the government of Hamid Karzai collapsed, in case they wanted a proxy force kept in reserve. And subsequently, Pakistan gave sanctuary to the Taliban leadership and a lot of these Taliban. Musharraf at home had held rigged elections in early 2002, which brought to power the fundamentalist parties in Pakistan, especially along the border with Afghanistan. So there were sort of multiple groups in Pakistan who wanted to support the Taliban. At the same time, he couldn't really buck the Americans. And here, I think the Americans were really at fault because their request to Musharraf was, you know, just hunt down the al-Qaeda leaders. We're not bothered about the Taliban. We don't care what you do with them, what happens to them. We're not really interested. Hunt down al-Qaeda, and there were huge rewards for al-Qaeda. So Pakistan's policy actually fell in line with what American policy was. And Pakistan did help hunt down several top Al-Qaeda leaders, not Osama bin Laden, but really managed to keep the Taliban completely on one side. And subsequently, of course, by 2003, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had regrouped. They had started getting in their supplies, recruiting from Pakistan and from Afghanistan, and they relaunched their guerrilla war. So it was a tragic tale, in my opinion, of an under-resourced war, which of course we see later in Iraq. There were too few troops in Iraq also, and generals were fired in the U.S. Army who dare raise the question with Rumsfeld that there were too few troops. So in many instances, you see many of the same mistakes that were made in Afghanistan being repeated in Iraq.
You were talking about this relationship between the Pakistani military and the Taliban and why they wanted to keep them alive. Where does their ongoing conflict with India fit into this?
Well, it's a very important part. I mean, Pakistan, the Pakistani military believed that the Karzai government, which was dominated by what was then called the Northern Alliance, was too pro-Indian, that the Indians would be back in Kabul, exerting influence over the Afghans. We should remember that the Indians had been ousted by the Taliban, so there'd be no Indians in Kabul, in fact, for almost a decade. And Pakistan felt that this border was completely clear of any Indian influence. Pakistan has had a very strained relationship. It's fought three wars with India. Musharraf himself had fought the most recent war in Kargil. Tensions were very high. And the Pakistanis just didn't want the Indians in there, but they were. They came back in obviously, like all other countries, they opened up their embassies. They provided aid to Afghanistan, etc. And then began what is still now a very hot kind of tit-for-tat a series of accusations where the Pakistanis are accusing the Indians of fueling unrest in Pakistan itself, and the Indians in turn are accusing Pakistan once again now of fueling unrest in Kashmir and other parts of India.
So, in effect, the army and intelligence services of Pakistan wanted to keep the Taliban in reserve because they thought this was an Afghan force that they could control, and this would give them potentially strategic depth inside Afghanistan. Do they hope that the Taliban would take over Afghanistan again?
Well, if you sum it up, I think there were three major reasons. The first reason was to keep India off balance. The second reason was, yes, to maintain influence in Afghanistan by keeping this proxy force resident in Pakistan. And in case, you know, the Americans pulled out. Of course, there were big fears at that time, but that many people thought that the lack of deployment of American troops meant, in fact, that the Americans would pull out after 6 months. And if that was the case, then obviously the Taliban would be backed by Pakistan to take control. The third reason simply is, I think now, at least which has been pursued by Musharraf in the last 3 or 4 years, has been that Pakistan has benefited enormously from American largesse during this time. We've received something like $11 billion in aid. So you wanted to keep the aid flow going. You wanted to keep the war going in Afghanistan. You wanted to keep Afghanistan destabilized so that the Americans and now NATO troops remain there. And Pakistan remains a crucial element. The Pakistan military remains very critical. And the Pakistan territory remains important for supplying the goods and munitions to U.S. forces in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan is landlocked. So all these multiple reasons, you know, give the regime reason to do what they did. And unfortunately, it was the Americans who really bought this line.
Well, yes, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, President Bush supposedly had been pressing General Musharraf for the last 7 years to crack down on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and we see the result. They're stronger than ever. What did Bush do so very, very wrong?
Well, I think the real issue was Iraq. I think Iraq was a huge distraction and diversion to not only the war effort but also nation building and the provision of resources to Afghanistan. You know, for example, the war ended in December and 2001, and 3 months later, in March, the U.S. began pulling out the special forces it had. They stopped deploying the satellites over large parts of Afghanistan, except the north where they thought bin Laden might be. They started pulling out resources, and everything was sent off for retraining for Iraq. So, and then at the same time they started paying the warlords to keep this peace in Afghanistan because there were so few American troops there. So, unfortunately, right from the beginning, you see the Bush policy in Afghanistan as being incredibly narrow. The only policy it has, not of nation building, not of stabilizing Afghanistan, only of catching Al-Qaeda's leaders. Not understanding that, you know, you're not going to catch Al-Qaeda's leaders if you don't have the people with you, if you don't do hearts and minds in the border regions, if you don't pursue the Taliban leadership with equally strong focus as you're doing for Al-Qaeda. And this policy was just allowed to drift for so many years because, of course, then the invasion, the preparations for the invasion of Iraq, the whole debate, the disputes with the Europeans, then the war, and then the insurgency in Iraq. And this policy, the American policy towards Afghanistan, just drifted.
All right, so you have a situation where for 7 years, the policy in Afghanistan has drifted, and the U.S. policy towards Pakistan, President Bush has relied on Musharraf, who was playing a double game, taking U.S. money, arresting or killing a few al-Qaeda people, but on the other hand, letting the Taliban set up bases and strengthen for Pakistan's own reason as a hedge against India. So that brings us up to the present. There were just elections in Pakistan, and many people hoped that with the election of a civilian government, which did occur, there might be a change of policy in the country and perhaps a leadership that could gather popular support in the country to crack down on the militants who were threatening Pakistan as well. And yet, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. It seems as if the new government is making deals with the militants that are going to enable al-Qaeda and the militants to become Taliban and others to become even stronger. So what's the story now?
Well, you know, the Bush administration for the first time asked the Pakistan Army to go into Fata, the tribal areas, in 2004. Now, that means that from 2001 to 2004, all the various Taliban factions, the Al-Qaeda, they had, you know, almost 3 years with which to organize themselves with complete sort of peace and harmony reigning in that part of, in the tribal areas. Now, what happens is that, of course, the same Pakistani tribesmen who bring across Taliban and Al-Qaeda and settle them down on the Pakistan side of the border, they themselves become Taliban because, you know, they're making huge amounts of money from Al-Qaeda. They're providing the safe houses, you know, the food, the accommodation, the supplies, etc., etc. And in the process, they become Talibanized. And we now, of course, the last 2 or 3 years, we have this phenomenon which we call the Pakistani Taliban. That is, Pakistanis who are now trying to literally conquer parts of northwestern Pakistan so they can set up even securer bases for Al-Qaeda. And they're all linked now, the Afghan Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, Al-Qaeda. It's an incredible melange of groups, and not counting groups from Central Asia, groups from Chechnya, militants from Europe who've been coming, etc. And there was the hope that after a lot of, again, pressure on Musharraf, domestic pressure, he was forced to hold elections, and unfortunately, the leader of the main party, Benazir Bhutto, was assassinated just 10 days before elections were due. The elections were postponed, they were held in February, and it has brought together a very good combination of political parties in a coalition government. Now, unfortunately, the coalition government was supposed to deal with many of these issues, but has got bogged down in internecine warfare between the various parties that make up the coalition. And it has not been able to make inroads against the army on its policy. Now, Pakistan's foreign policy has traditionally, especially policy towards India and Afghanistan, has traditionally always been in the hands of the military. And the military are not giving up now, especially with this very weak civilian government. And what is needed is for the Americans to support the civilian government, to help strengthen it. But instead what we're seeing is President Bush is still supporting President Musharraf. Who himself, just a few days ago, I was in Washington, Bush gave another statement in support of Musharraf because there were rumors that he might be resigning or being forced to resign. This, I think, has been, you know, hugely detrimental because Musharraf is now really a spanner in the works. He's part of the problem, not part of the solution. And when President Bush supports, the dictator, I mean, what kind of message are you sending to the Pakistani political parties, to the people, to the results of this election, which has actually elected quite a good government?
All right, I'm just going to ask a couple more questions and throw it open to you, and I'm going to come back to this point about what the next president should do. But before I get to that, let me just ask you, there are negotiations going on now between the Pakistani military, although the government is supposedly involved, the new government, and the militants. And there's a lot of debate in this country, in the administration, in the U.S. military, about whether these negotiations are simply going to give up the whole game to the militants. Previous negotiations failed miserably. The militants just used them to rearm. Should we be looking at these negotiations as a positive thing that the U.S. should support, or are they a dangerous thing?
Well, I mean, I've personally been very critical of these negotiations because, first of all, they've been conducted solely by the army. They were conducted, they started well before the elections. They were carried out in secret between the army and the Pakistani Taliban leadership. And two or three things, you know, have resulted. First of all, the army is withdrawing from the Fatah, and it is leaving Fatah, it is leaving only paramilitary forces there. The regular army itself is withdrawing. Secondly, there's no surveillance, or there's no part of this deal which prevents the Pakistani Taliban and all the Taliban gathered in Fatah from crossing into Afghanistan and attacking American forces and Afghan forces there. I was in Kabul just before coming to the U.S., and I spoke at length with President Karzai, and, I mean, the Afghans, the American military, the foreign diplomats, they are deeply frustrated by this, because what it's going to mean is, first of all, there will not be proper security forces to control the border. These Taliban on the Pakistani side will be free to cross into Afghanistan. And thirdly, this withdrawal of the army is going to lead to further Talibanization in Pakistan. Already we have the Pakistani Taliban moving down from the mountains into the plains, trying to terrorize, harass villages and major towns and cities in the northwest part of the country to try and convert them to their idea of what a new state should be. They want a full Islamic state, and they want the defeat of the of this present elected government. So there seems to be an enormous reluctance by the military to either take on security on the border or to help international forces in Afghanistan by keeping the Taliban away from Afghanistan, or to even prevent the Talibanization of the northwest part of Pakistan. And this is creating enormous consternation, not only here, Trudy, it's also creating immense worry in Pakistan.
Well, just a last question before I turn it over. If you were advising the next president of whichever party after November, U.S. president, what would you suggest that he do?
Well, I think there are two very big issues that, you know, really should be seen. One is that I write about the whole region. It's a very large panorama that I try and write about. I don't know if I succeed or not, but anyway. But what I see is that this region has now become totally interlocking. You cannot deal, you know, when the U.S. went into Afghanistan and then NATO went in 2005, they tried to deal with Afghanistan as though this was a landlocked country with four walls and four boundaries, and we didn't have to look sort of to the east or to the west, you know. But the point is that you can't deal with Afghanistan unless you end the sanctuaries in Pakistan. You can't deal with Pakistan unless you bring the Indians and the Pakistanis closer together. You can't deal with security in Western Afghanistan unless you deal with Iran and Iran's influence there. And you have to talk to the Iranians. The Iranians, I think, basically would like to see a stable Afghanistan, but they're very worried as to, they fear an American attack on them. And they fear that that attack could come from Afghanistan. So they have every interest to try and destabilize both the Kabul government and the American presence there. So what I'm trying to say here is that this, and Central Asia is interlocked into this also. You have to have a regional strategy. You have to look at this region as a whole, and you have to conduct sort of multipolar diplomacy in order to try and bring this region together and try and resolve the problems. And the core, obviously, is to stabilize Afghanistan and Pakistan. But in order to do that, you have to look at the region as a whole and bring in all these neighboring countries also. Then you have to have a country-specific policy, obviously. Afghanistan certainly needs more resources of all kinds. The infrastructure has, you know, the road network has been built after a long period of time. There's still no power in the country. Kabul has 4 to 5 hours of electricity every second day, you know. So how do you build an economy on when the capital of the country has no power? How do you build factories or provide jobs to people or have workshops or do anything when there is no power? There is this chronic shortage of infrastructure. There hasn't been very much capacity building in the government itself. The ministries are very inadequate 7 years on. They still can't perform even basic functions. They can't distribute aid. They don't know how to do it, etc. So, I mean, then you have to have a specific strategy to specific countries. I think Pakistan needs a lot of attention. We are beset by internal problems which have fueled this militancy. For example, education and the whole culture of madrasas, the religious schools. Not all of them are militant, but a lot of them are training militants. Now, the Pakistan government needs to spend far more on state education so you can provide an alternative to these madrasa schools. Now, you need the support of the international community for that. Unfortunately, the Americans have given us all this money for the last 7 years, but 80% of this money has gone to the military. It hasn't gone to social works and building society and state building, etc. So I think, you know, these are the two things I would say. You need more resources. And if I may just mention, you know, I say in the book very forcefully that, you know, Iraq is a sideshow compared to Afghanistan, Pakistan. And what do I mean by that? I just mean that Iraq, ultimately, the new president obviously will have to handle Iraq first of all. But Iraq ultimately is a Middle East problem. It's going to be settled once the neighbors of Iraq come together and are brought together by hopefully the new president, the United Nations, whoever it might be, and agree on not interfering in Iraq, which those neighbors include Iran. I mean, you cannot stabilize Iraq without talking to the Iranians. And eventually there will be a political settlement, but it will be a settlement amongst the neighboring countries, amongst the Arabs, basically, in which, you know, you may have some good spin-offs. Like, for example, the Israelis will have to be involved, the Iranians will have to be involved, and maybe you can build more cohesion in the Middle East. But Iraq is not a global it's not threatening global security. You have had no terrorist attack anywhere in Europe or anywhere else in the world launched from Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has been very effective and very strong, but it has proved incapable of controlling territory, nor has it been able to launch any terrorist attack worldwide. But on the other hand, Pakistan, Afghanistan, in this region, you have all these training camps. They are training all sorts of people from all over the world. They're expanding territorial control of areas in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And this is, this part of the world is a global threat. It's a threat to the whole world, as I see it.
On that note, let us have questions. Yes, over here, and the mic is coming down. So just down here in front. This gentleman in the 1, 2, 3, 4th row. Right there. And if you, no, you don't need to identify yourself.
Thank you. We talked a little bit before about nuclear weapons. How worried should we be about Pakistan's arsenal?
Well, you know, first of all, the nuclear weapons are controlled by the military. And the military is a disciplined, hierarchical organization, and it's very unlikely. In all 60 years, we've had many coups and many martial laws, but we've never had a colonel's coup, or we've never had a brigadier's coup. It's always been the commander-in-chief who's done the coup. So I think, you know, the army has these nuclear weapons under control. And more than that, I think since 2001, there's been a lot of cooperation between the U.S. and Pakistan with the U.S. providing various safeguards to Pakistan, in order to keep these nuclear weapons safe. Now, having said that, I think the real danger is still the issue of proliferation. Some of Pakistan's top scientists were proliferating nuclear technology to Iran, to Libya, to North Korea, to, you know, perhaps other countries even. That has been controlled now. But there's no doubt that there's a very large chunk of technical people in Pakistan who are very knowledgeable about the nuclear process. And the danger is that, you know, those people may proliferate their knowledge rather than nuclear, their know-how, rather than actual nuclear parts to extremist groups. And that has to be watched. And I think, you know, again, that would be watched much better, perhaps, with the civilian government working with the military and with the international community.
All right, let me just take one in back, and we'll come back in front.
Yeah, this is about the nuclear issue. It's about AQ Khan, the scientist who gave secrets, I think, to Iran and North Korea. Is it true that the Pakistani military government, released him from house arrest recently? I think I heard that. I'm not sure if that's true or not. And secondly, if we get into a confrontation with Pakistan in the future, do we have to worry about their nuclear arsenal being not turned on us here in the United States, but do we have to worry about them selling nuclear secrets to other countries that may want to hurt us? Like, it's really kind of worrying to think about this.
The question, in case anyone didn't hear, was, has A.Q. Khan, the Pakistani father of the nuclear bomb who proliferated to Iran, North Korea, et cetera, has he been released from house arrest? And if so, do we need to worry about more sales of nuclear materials around the world?
No, he hasn't been freed from house arrest, but the restrictions upon him have been relaxed. For example, he didn't have access to a telephone. He now does. And he's been giving interviews to journalists who phone him up. And he's been allowed to meet his family and other things. But he hasn't been released under house arrest. I think for the Pakistan military, it's a very big issue. Because if A.Q. Khan is very bitter about the treatment he received at the hands of Musharraf, he's very bitter about the treatment he received at the hands of the military, he would probably, if he was freed, he would probably come out and say, well, everything I did under orders. I wasn't acting alone. I was acting, with the military, and the military was making money on the sale of this nuclear technology. So the issue is, very, very sensitive, and the Bush administration really gave Musharraf a pass on this back in when the scandal erupted in 2004-2005, the next administration is going to have to deal with this issue. Because it certainly, if it's Obama and the Democrats come in, the Democrats traditionally, as you know, have always been much tougher on proliferation of nuclear technology and all than the Republicans have. And certainly for the within the Democrats, I think there's going to be much more pressure on Pakistan to come clean as to what exactly it gave or what exactly it knows about the proliferation that happened and who all were involved.
That will be interesting. Is this gentleman in front?
Hi, I have two questions. I'll just ask them sequentially, and just you can then answer them.
Could I ask, I know someone asked two, if we could limit it to one just so we can get more questions. If we have enough time, we'll come around again.
Well,
all right, you'll be the last one. You ask your two quickly, then after that, if we could limit it to one so we have more time.
I wonder if you could address the 800-pound invisible gorilla that I think is in the room. He's standing behind you, and that is Saudi Arabia, which I don't think the madrasas would be there. Somebody's got to provide the funding for these places, and my guess is it's Saudi Arabia. My second question is, I've heard you many times on NPR and stuff. A lot of times you're broadcasting from London. Is that right?
No, I'm from Pakistan normally.
I'm just wondering, and I don't mean this facetiously, is your life in danger? Do you have to take security precautions in any way?
Did you all hear that? The second question was, is your life in danger because of the things you say? And the first question was about the madrasas and Saudi funding, and will that problem go on?
Well, you know, the Saudi thing is a very complicated issue. I mean, the largest supply of the world's oil comes from Saudi Arabia, and no country, the Americans included, are willing to really squeeze the Saudis. Now, the Saudis have faced, first, of course, they spent the first 2 years after 9/11 in total denial about everything. That, you know, these boys who did the 19 hijackers were not Saudi and all the rest of it. But anyway, I mean, I think we've moved on since then. I mean, the Saudis now do acknowledge what has been happening. They have been victims of al-Qaeda attacks themselves. They've cracked down very hard on al-Qaeda there. But I agree with you. I mean, the problem is not so much the al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, but the money. Now, the Saudis backed the Taliban in the 1990s for a long period of time. They backed the Pakistan military also, and a lot of Saudi money has flown to these madrasas in Pakistan in the 90s. I don't believe now that the Saudi state is involved in any way in funding either al-Qaeda or the Taliban or even these madrasas. A lot of that has been curtailed. But there's still a lot of private Saudi and Gulf money that is floating around. Nobody really knows, you know, where it's going. Now, you know, have the Americans cracked down sufficiently on this private money, which would probably be quite easy to track, not that difficult to track? No, they haven't. But there are princes and rich businessmen who believe in the message of the Taliban or believe in the message of some of these militant groups who run the madrasas, and that money has been there. On the other hand, let me just say that the Saudis have now initiated, you know, they captured a lot of al-Qaeda people, and they have now initiated a program of bringing these prisoners, these former al-Qaeda militants, under a kind of rehabilitation program. And they put them, they remove them from jail, they put them in under house arrest, and then they kind of re-educate them with mullahs and scholars, Islamic scholars, and they try and re-educate them about Islam. And that's quite an innovative program, and other countries are now actually trying to follow suit. So, you know, again, there's this mixture of things. On the other question, at times, yes. I mean, without a doubt, you know. I think every time there's been a civilian government in Pakistan, it's been easier to speak out. The media has been freer. During this period of military rule, it's always very much more difficult to speak out. It's more difficult to write. It's more difficult to speak out, and one is naturally fearful, both from the government side and from the extremist side, because the extremists, of course, have been targeting all sorts of people, like journalists and aid workers, and etc.
Gentleman here with the striped jersey.
I'm wondering if you see any threat to the current government of Pakistan from the Taliban within Pakistan. Is there anything that could disrupt the current government there?
Well, the long-term view is no, because, you know, Pakistanis are, broadly speaking, not extremists, and they're very fearful of this Taliban phenomenon. This Talibanization process is happening in the northwest of the country amongst the Pashtuns, which is the same ethnic group who inhabit Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, and also from where the Taliban came. Now, we have extremist groups in other parts of the country amongst other ethnic groups, but we don't have this kind of wave of Talibanization. And I think the most positive thing about Pakistan was this election. This election elected the People's Party to the center, as the government in the center, which is, broadly speaking, a secular party, and is very anti-fundamentalist, very anti-army and fundamentalist. And it elected in the Northwest Frontier Province, which borders Afghanistan, it elected the Awami National Party. This is a secular Pashtun party, which believes in non-violence, and is part of the Gandhi philosophy, going back to the 1930s and the freedom struggle against the British in India. And this party has been out of power for about 30 years, and they have come back in a very big way. And they are, you know, going to be hopefully, improving the situation there. So they're a countervailing force within the Pashtun society. This party is a countervailing force to the Taliban. I think that's the importance of democracy. Democracy, the once Pakistanis were given the choice, they didn't vote in the fundamentalists, they didn't vote in the party loyal to the military, they voted in anti-army, anti-mullah parties. And I think that has been very positive.
There's a gentleman in the middle here, towards the back.
I wonder if you can define what you mean by nation, and then as a result of that, you mentioned before the difficulty of just addressing Afghanistan without looking at the whole region. It seems to me that the people there look at themselves as something other than how we understand them being a nation. And the other related question is, what is America's interest in trying to address nation building other than, you know, like the issue of terrorism, which some people doubt that Al-Qaeda will ever be able to mount another terrorist attack as they did in 2001?
I didn't understand the question.
I know that we need to condense that into one sharper question.
Sorry, I didn't.
Nation building.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get it either. Can you, one question concisely?
Right. Look, I mean, the whole point about these extremist groups is that you have to have the population on your side. Now, when the Americans went into Afghanistan, what was absolutely remarkable was that, you know, 90% of Afghans supported the overthrow of the Taliban. They supported the presence of foreign troops there initially. Now, you know, here you were dealing, and the American media at that time, if you remember, was full of stories about how the Afghans hate foreigners, and they kicked out the Soviets, and they kicked out the British, and they kicked out everybody else, and they'll never tolerate the Americans, and we should just pack up and go home. Now, actually, the Afghans welcomed the Americans for one reason only, not because they loved America, but because they presumed that these foreign troops are going to bring with them the money to change their lives and to rebuild this country devastated by 30 years of war. The Afghans had faced the Soviets, the civil war, etc., etc. So they really, their expectations were incredibly high. And there was this huge window of opportunity, which, you know, in my opinion, lasted for about 3 years, when Afghan goodwill was on the side of the Western alliance, expecting the West to rebuild their country. Now, why? I mean, you know, why should, I mean, George Bush came in saying no nation building. Why should have George Bush rebuilt Afghanistan? And, you know, the theme of my book, I mean, simply that you do not deal with extremism by hounding it militarily. It can't be done. You can't defeat extremism purely on a military basis. You have to win the population over. You have to give the population something to fight for, something to live for. You have to offer their children something. And the fact is that, you know, Afghanistan was this devastated country which could easily go back to being a failed state and a terrorist haven if something was not done. And I fear very much that, you know, that is the lack of resources that have been put into Afghanistan as compared to Iraq and other places might well push Afghanistan back into this kind of failed state status. I give you one example, which is in my book. I mean, the Americans pulled out in 2002, you know, and I said for 3 years there was virtually there wasn't even satellite surveillance of the whole of Afghanistan. So forget troops on the ground. You weren't even watching your TV monitors because, you know, it was all the satellites that we moved to Iraq. Now, what happened? In 2005, NATO comes in and more American troops come in, but there's been this three-year gap. And now the Americans want to pick up where they left off. They want the same intelligence sources. They want the tribes to give them the intelligence on where Al-Qaeda might be. And, of course, they meet a big zero. Because, you know, after 4 years, everybody thought, well, where the hell have you been? You know, you were supposed to rebuild our village, give us schools, give us roads, you know, help us, and then we would provide you with the intelligence as to where Al-Qaeda is. For 4 years, you were missing. And now you expect us just to kind of happily come back and start feeding you with information as to where the bad guys are? So, you know, it doesn't happen like that. You needed some consistency, some consistent presence there. And that's why nation building is important. You don't want more failed states. You don't want more Afghanistans in this world. There are parts of Africa that are becoming failed states. I'm not saying that this burden has to be borne solely by America. I'm saying the burden has to be borne by the international community, by your allies, by the West, by the Europeans, the Japanese, the Arabs, you know. But it needs a president with vision. Whether we like it or not, America is still very much the leader of the world. And we need a president with vision who can bring the world together to help these issues. Today in the world, we are facing huge problems such as climate change and HIV, and these are problems that can't be resolved by the Americans alone, or by one country, or by 10 countries. They have to be resolved by the whole world working together. Now, you know, all I'm saying is we need leadership, both here and in our own countries, to be able to work together and to tackle these problems.
Gentleman back there on the side.
I wonder, do you have any growing concern that the United States is going to be less able to do these things that you think are necessary because of our own economic problems, oil prices, our economy in general, lost jobs, et cetera, et cetera? So can we pick up that burden, or are you concerned about that?
Well, I agree. This is a huge problem, and I think, you know, the neglect of the social structure here, this massive spending on Iraq, I mean, it's $600 billion have gone so far. It may be at $1 trillion or $2 trillion by the time this war ends. I hope the next president does start a process of pulling out troops, helping to stabilize the region around Iraq and ultimately stabilizing Iraq. But again, I just go back to what I said. I don't think this is solely America's responsibility. It is your responsibility to provide leadership. But it is the rest of the world's responsibility to come together under that leadership to provide the necessary resources for countries like Afghanistan. Yes, more American money would be good, but so would more European money, or more Arab money, or more Japanese money. I think all that is needed. But all that needs a president with strategic vision who's not going to shut himself up in a box and do everything unilaterally and say, you know, America will invade Iraq unilaterally, America will invade Afghanistan unilaterally, but will work with the rest of the world. This is a period of history, which is full of conflict and unrest and mega, mega problems that we are facing.
All right, we'll just take a couple of questions. All right, yes, this gentleman here.
You talk about, you know, what the next president should do. And I guess one question I have with regard to that is the current administration supports Karzai and Musharraf. Who would you recommend that the next president turn to as the leaders within those countries?
Well, I mean, you know, there are going to be elections in Afghanistan next year. I hope they can be held and that the insurgency doesn't get so bad that they can't be held. Karzai will be standing, but so will other people be standing against him. And I think it's going to be in America's interest to see a free and fair election. If Karzai is defeated, there should be a peaceful transfer of power to the next president. We don't know who the leader in Afghanistan is going to be next year. In Pakistan, I hope the next president supports the civilian government and drop support for Musharraf, because Musharraf has become, part of the problem, not part of the solution. I don't think it's America's job to choose leaders. It's America's job to support the result of, democratic transition, which is happening in both countries. And that is something that is very positive. If only this insurgency could be controlled. What these countries need is support in curbing this insurgency. Not just military support, as I said, but also, nation-building support, infrastructure, education, all these other things that need to be done. And secondly, what is needed is to bring the world together to do this. You can't do this unilaterally.
Gentleman all the way at the back.
Thank you. As a follow-up to that, what you just said, I'm concerned about the tribal areas in the northwest of Pakistan. I've seen some documentaries, and I've seen like a sign at the border. It says, in essence, no visitors beyond this point. It seems kind of isolationist. You add that to the military negotiating and saying, okay, we're going to leave your region alone if you just, and just basically draw a line right there at the border, and enabling Taliban to develop more in that region. Is Pakistan trying to incorporate the tribal areas into their own economy, like, providing schools in that area, or are they being just basically left thrown devices?
Well, there is a plan to do so. The Americans are willing to give money. But I think the basic issue, again, is not being addressed by the military. And that is that the tribal areas are ruled by the president directly under a set of laws which were made by the British 200 years ago. They do not come under the writ of the Pakistani state. They do not come under the Pakistani constitution. The rule of law that applies in the rest of Pakistan doesn't apply in the tribal areas. Now, what is needed is political reform, first of all. You need to bring the tribal areas under, within Pakistan's ambit, within the constitution, so that the writ of law, and that then the tribal people can benefit from, all the social services and et cetera, that other Pakistanis receive. That, I think, is absolutely critical. Now, this civilian government is very much in favor of this. Now, obviously, this can't happen overnight because the whole tribal area at the moment is in the grip of the Taliban. The Taliban are going to say, we don't want any of your political reforms. We want an Islamic state here. But I think it's important that the civilian government and the military come together and announce an intention and then slowly, slowly, step by step, take measures which will bring the tribal areas into the ambit of the state. So you're not left with this kind of no man's land, which nobody claims authority over, and which can be used by these groups. I just wanted to say one thing to this gentleman down here about, you know, I think what has encouraged me is Barack Obama has spoken about more resources for Afghanistan. That is very encouraging. McCain has not said very much about Afghanistan. And presumably that is because, you know, if Afghanistan goes down the tubes, I mean, he doesn't, you know, he finds it difficult because, you know, his republic, the former Republican president was perhaps responsible for that, you know, President Bush. So I think it's important that, Afghanistan is an issue in this election. I think it's a very important issue, Pakistan and Afghanistan. I hope it is debated now that the two of them are now standing against each other. And I think this is a very, is as much of an important part of the world as Iraq is. Now, clearly to the Americans, I mean, because you have so many soldiers there, so many soldiers are dying there, Iraq does have primacy in the presidential debates that will no doubt come in the next few months. But I hope that this is, Afghanistan and Pakistan are discussed also. I hope this book contributes to the debate within America about the importance of this region and why it needs to be looked at very closely and why decisions need to be made, and both the leaders need to flesh out their policies as to what they would do with Pakistan and Afghanistan. So you know, and we know also, what these leaders would want to do.
On that note, I'm going to thank Ahmed very much for being with us, and he will be signing books upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.